Hello and welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. You can find more podcasts on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast features a keynote address from the 2010 Mid-Atlantic Regional Conference. It's a speech by Polly McClure, Vice President Emeritus for Cornell University. Her speech is entitled, Are We Having Fun Yet? Applying Positive Psychology in Challenging Times.
Thank you for coming. We're all aware of the serious financial situation that our country and the world really has experienced the last few years, and certainly the impact on our institutions of higher education has not been altogether positive. States have had serious revenue shortfalls. Federal state grants have been harder to come by. And, of course, the headlines and articles have been full of reports of 20 and 30% losses from our endowments. Many of our institutions depend on endowment income, even for part of our basic operating funds. And others may not be using them for operating funds, but have major building projects that they started in anticipation of having those revenues to pay the bills. At the same time that we're having these adverse financial impacts, many of our institutions are experiencing enrollment pressure as people either are out of work or fear they may be out of work and have an interest in upgrading their skills, looking for better employment options. So it's in that context that some people in our IT organizations are experiencing low morale and malaise with the accompanying loss of energy and productivity and sometimes degraded creativity. And so what I wanted us to talk about this morning for a while is some of the ways that each of us can help bring back up our own positive attitudes and also help spread that positive attitude to our colleagues. Before we talk about that, let's review where we're starting from. There's been a lot happening to us in higher ed, IT, and these are just a few of them. The ECAR organization has been compiling information about the impact of the recession on IT, and last week they were willing to share some preliminary data with me, which I'll pass on. There's widespread reduction in IT budgets. Over half of us have had significant reductions, permanent reductions in IT funding over the last couple of years. Over a third of us have had permanent reductions of 5% or more. Over a fifth of us experienced reductions of 10% or more. And I know some institutions that are significantly beyond 10%. We're experiencing layoffs. Almost a third of us either have or are facing planned layoffs. A quarter of our institutions have furloughs in the IT department, and almost everybody, well over 80%, have a hiring freeze. Retirement incentives. Many of our institutions have implemented positive incentives to move people out of the institution who are eligible for retirement. At Cornell, that program resulted in the loss of about 20 FTEs in the IT department. And many of those people were our most experienced and in some ways most valuable people in the organization. We're also looking at reorganizations. As our provosts and presidents and CFOs are looking at IT, one of the things they see is duplication between distributed and central IT. And they're looking to find ways of squeezing that duplication and waste out of the institution. That results in reorganization and rearrangement of responsibilities among people. And then even as we're undergoing those kinds of changes, We see even greater increases in demands for our services because the other departments in the university are trying to save costs, and they turn to IT for the mechanisms to do that. So the important thing here, though, from the things that are happening to us, is that it can produce a pervasive atmosphere of loss and risk and fear of adverse activities. And it can be a constant long-term chronic source of stress for the IT staff. Now, I'm assuming, and I think I know, that there have been other talks in this conference, and there are plenty of articles about ways that you can virtualize your machine room and do your IT stuff in a way that might be more cost-effective. And I'm not going to talk about any of those. Instead, what I'm going to talk about how we feel in this context and some of the things we can do to change the way we feel in our work environment. First of all, we feel a loss of control. A lot of the changes are imposed on us. We don't know, we may not know, exactly what to do as a result of the requests that are made of us. Sometimes we're just given targets, and somehow we're supposed to figure out what to do to meet those targets. Some of us feel angry some of the time because senior administrators, maybe provosts, faculty members, presidents, essentially lay solutions on us. And with our experience in managing IT, it feels to us like they don't know what they're doing, and basically they're imposing the wrong kinds of solutions, and that makes us mad. We resent being asked to do some unpleasant things. We may be told, if we're directors or supervisors or managers, that we have to reduce headcount. And there may be policies in our states and in our institutions about how we have to do that. And sometimes when you apply those little formulas, it results in IT in a conclusion that you got to lay off exactly the people that you shouldn't be laying off. And also, some of the people that you have to lay off are your friends, and they're people that you've worked with for the last 20 years. And if you're the manager or you're the supervisor, you're the one who has to tell those people. If you're not the supervisor, you have to sit next to the person once they've been told, and next to their empty chair when they're gone. We may feel inadequate in the face of all of this, and we may be actually worried about our own jobs, particularly if we try to argue with the powers that be about the proposals for what we should do. So that's kind of how we feel. We turn around and we look at the people that we're working with every day and how they're feeling. They're all worried about losing their jobs, even the most productive and effective and apparently self-confident among them. They read it in the newspaper, they hear it on the news, and they see that it's actually happening. Even if they're not worried about losing their job, they're worried about losing their projects. We geeks really care about our projects. And when a project that we're involved with goes on the chopping block, it almost feels like we're losing a member of the family. We feel grief at losing our colleagues. We fear loss of status. Sometimes when reorganizations happen, our position gets downgraded, some of our responsibilities go somewhere else, or we report to somebody that's different and maybe not where we'd like. They feel resentment about the extra work that's upon them. And if we're in a supervisory or management position, our colleagues may blame us for not having done a better job of defending them and fending off the adverse consequences. But during these times, we need to be smart constructive and energetic members of the institutional team in order to help find the best way through this thicket. So what's needed of us? First of all, we need to exhibit dedication and loyalty to our organization and to the institution, even when we feel like sometimes we want to separate from that because of all the things I've just said, but we need to be in there. We need creativity. Solving the problems we're talking about here are not simple cookbook matters. It requires the best of our thinking to come up with good solutions. Hard work and sustained effort. People in IT at every institution where I've worked have always worked incredibly hard. But with the staff declining and the expectations of us going up, we're going to be asked, and we are being asked, to put in extra hours and sustained effort. The institution needs clear, objective analysis from us. We need to be able to look at the options in a dispassionate way, evaluate the pluses and minuses, and recommend good solutions. We all, of course, feel a responsibility to look after the interests of IT, but we have to do our analytical work in the framework of what's best for the institution, not only what's best for the IT organization. Timely decisions. We're being asked to make difficult decisions about very complex alternatives and to implement those changes in a time frame that's almost unheard of in the institutions where I've worked. And that doesn't allow us to do the extended analysis that makes us a lot more comfortable. So this is a time where we have to act, and we have to act quickly. And it may require that we rely on our intuition about those alternatives more than we analytic people are really comfortable with. But that's all we can do. And then the institution needs our collaborative spirit. We can't hunker down and defend what's best for IT. Sometimes we have to give more than the other departments are giving in order for the greater good to prevail. So the question is, do the responses that I listed on that chart that the institution needs from us happen naturally under the conditions of the first three slides that I showed you? That is, conditions of people feeling threatened and focused on loss. Well, no, not necessarily. For some people, maybe it does, but for many people, it doesn't. And many folks will just shut down or withdraw, sometimes demonstrating overt negative and counterproductive behaviors, just exactly the opposite of what we need. So the question is, how can we create a positive attitude under the conditions that exist? And we want to talk here about some ways to help ourselves as individuals move into a more positive, optimistic place, and also at the same time to help bring along our colleagues so that we create an overall environment that will allow us to do what we need to do. We know from very good research that a positive attitude not only reduces personal stress, it helps us live longer, significantly longer, and it also increases our productivity at work, and I believe will help us demonstrate those behaviors as well. And the way I'm going to do this is sort of in three chunks. The first chunk is I'm going to indulge a little bit in sharing some insight from my long career as a manager in IT, and then I want to briefly highlight two areas of research. There's not enough time to go into it in depth at all, but at least I'll give you some keywords and some names of people so that if you're interested, you can get on Google or maybe go to the library and learn some more. The two disciplines, number one, positive psychology. That's easy to remember. And the second one goes under the label of appreciative inquiry. To begin with my own experience, one of the things that I kept from the bulletin board that was beside my desk when I retired last July was an old scratched up, rewritten list that I'd kept and revised over the 30-odd years as a manager. That list was sort of my cumulative attempt to understand in simple terms what really mattered to people about their work environment. And this is the list that existed on that last day. I'm showing it to you here because in times of difficulty, I've often found myself going back to that list to ground me as I tried to figure out how I could help people feel comfortable, maybe even happy, about doing the work that we needed to do. Basically, the idea here is if we can figure out what's important to people and we can give each other a little bit more of that, maybe we can improve the climate for all of us. So I want to quickly go through the list. People want a feeling of belonging. Basically, folks want to be a part of a group that's doing important things. That's pretty easy for us in IT. Everybody recognizes the central role of technology in higher education today. Help people understand the higher purpose there and their part in making that happen. We work in institutions of higher education, which is a noble enterprise, and we're part of a technology profession that's really setting the stage for the next generation of society. So that shouldn't be too hard to help your colleagues feel like they belong to something important. Second, people want a feeling of being appreciated. In our organization at Cornell, every couple of months we had an all-hands meeting. And the first little segment in that all-hands meeting was a segment in which people could send in essentially acknowledgments, thank yous, for other people in the organization, and it was my honor to read those in the all-hands meeting. I have to say, I never saw anything but radiant smiles from the people who were being thanked by their colleagues, sometimes for really major, major things, and sometimes for just little things, but it can make a huge difference. And you don't have to have a public meeting recognition. You can tell somebody thank you at the water fountain or over the coffee pot. The important thing I've learned about recognition and appreciation is there are three important characteristics. It needs to be individualized. Don't generalize it. Oh, everybody over there in that department really done good this week. That doesn't help anybody. But, Chip, you did a fantastic job of working with the governor's staff last month. You got our proposal approved, and nobody else could have done that. That makes a bigger impact. So it needs to be individualized, it needs to be specific to what the person did, and of course, I guess it goes without saying, it needs to be deserved. You can't give false recognition. So you can gather that I don't think these Employee of the Month programs have the kind of impact that I'm suggesting here by saying that people need to be appreciated. Third thing is people want to feel that they have some influence, at least, over decisions that affect them. Anytime you can let the people involved in an issue make or at least recommend those decisions, it can make a huge difference. This last spring, we had to cut what's called the food budget in the IT organizations. The coffee fund, the cookies, the pizza lunches, you know, parties at Christmas time, that kind of thing. And, of course, the temptation was just to tell the directors to figure out how to cut, you know, 50% out of their food budget. And we didn't do that. We set up a staff committee to go off and recommend how we should do that. By and large, they came back with exactly the right answers. And, in fact, it made a huge difference in how accepting the rest of the staff was of the work because they felt involved. a feeling of being involved in a worthwhile activity. Geeks like to feel that there's a higher purpose to what they do, and people in higher education work for noble goals. So IT and higher education, multiply those together. Clearly, that's important, and we've already talked about some of the things that are important to do there. People want to believe that they're trusted. I mention this especially right now because under conditions of, you know, constriction of budgets, there's always a temptation to rush in with controls to make sure there's no waste and that nobody breaks the rules. My view is this is absolutely the wrong time to put that kind of control in place because staff interpret it as that we don't trust them. We may have to put controls in place a year or two or 3 years down the road in order to be able to prove to somebody that we, in fact, are being good managers. But to implement new personally oriented controls under these circumstances is a very tricky thing, and I think we need to be careful about it. People want to believe that they have a good future ahead of them. Now, one way of looking at it is that that's kind of hard to do under these circumstances. But there's another layer that says it's not so hard, and that is that we're making the changes that we're making today in order that there will be a good future out there for our institution, the students, the professors, and the people that work in the IT organization. It's important to repeat over and over again that picture of the good future that we're working towards so that people don't lose track of it. People want to feel that they're respected, and that's especially important under these circumstances. And they also want a recognition that they have a life outside of work and that that also is important. Under these circumstances, we're asking people to work more hours and work harder in many ways. And I think when we ask people to do that, it's important, even if we have to do it, to acknowledge that we understand that there's an impact on their personal life and that we value that personal life. Some of the things I've found that help with that, you know, when you actually get to know people in your IT organization, they're an incredibly talented and diverse set of people. We have guys who run fireworks shows, design the most unbelievable fireworks shows and carry them out. We have sculptors. We have woodworkers. We have quilters. We have people with unbelievable talents. What if you had, you know, one afternoon where you set up a demonstration and let people see the products of our folks outside talents. Always, we want to try to minimize how much extra work we're asking from people, but I think there are some compensating things we can do to indicate that we value them as whole people, not just as cogs in a machine. Okay, that's the story from my list. Now what I want to do is move on and talk about these two research areas. First of all, positive psychology. The discipline that goes under that name is a fairly recent discipline. It was born of the work, as far as I know, of two people, Don Clifton, who started publishing in this area back in the 60s, 70s. Don was recognized in 2002 by the American Psychological Association as the grandfather of positive psychology. The whole movement was given greater visibility in the 90s by Martin Seligman, who designated it as his theme when he was elected president of the American Psychological Association. Basically, what they pointed out is that the vast majority of research in psychology has been about what was wrong with people and what to do to fix those wrong things. And their realization, which I think is absolutely correct, is that just not being a psychopath or just not being depressed doesn't mean that you're happy or that you're leading a meaningful life. And so it was looking on the other side of the issue, namely, what makes people happy? What helps people create a meaningful life that gave them the discipline that goes under the name of positive psychology? And in certainly the last decade, the last 15 years, there's been a huge amount of research, and I think a lot of it has very practical implications for us. We all know that the world has basically pessimistic people, and there are optimistic people. Now, pessimistic people have a sort of a mindset. They believe that troubles will last forever. So if a trouble comes up, oh my God, that's just going to be there forever. They believe that troubles undermine everything that they're trying to do, and that troubles can't be controlled. They just happen to you. So a pessimist with that worldview, when they run into obstacles, they give up. It's the only sensible thing to do if that's the way you think the world works. Optimistic people, on the other hand, tend to have a mindset that interprets troubles as transients. Oh, that's a problem today, but, you know, it'll go away. They believe that troubles are controllable. You can do something about them. It's not that they just get inflicted on you. And they also see troubles as specific to the situation. Well, that happened over there, but it's not necessarily going to undermine what we're doing over here. And people then, with an optimistic worldview, when they run into an obstacle, they just simply put their head down, they dig in, and they try harder, and they find a way to solve the problem. Now, people seem to be naturally more pessimists or more optimists, just maybe from the time they're hatched. But Seligman's work on learned optimism shows that if you're on the pessimistic side to start with, you can learn and you can help yourself become more of an optimist. And since right now we need a lot more optimistic people to dig in and solve those problems. Three things I want to point out from the research on positive psychology. The first one is that happiness is contagious. There was an article in the British Medical Journal about a year or a year and a half ago by Fowler and Christakis. And they went back and reanalyzed the data from the long-term Framingham Heart Study, which I'm sure you've all heard about in other contexts. In addition to the physical measures that that study took, it also took attitude and psychological measures of the participants. They analyzed the data, and out of that came the conclusion that if one person, let's say we're talking about me, if I'm a happy person, the likelihood of my close associates also being happy is increased by 15%. And the likelihood of the close associates of my close associate also being happy are increased by 10%. And the likelihood that the associates of my associates being happy are also higher, in that case, by 6%. They call this 3 degrees of influence, and the numbers I gave you are all statistically significant, so we're not making up small numbers here. So the second study that these two people did was sort of cute. They went to Facebook, and they studied the Facebook pages of about 1,700 students. This was published in Nature in 2008. And they had people code the pictures in terms of, are those people smiling and happy, or are those, you know, disgruntled or sad or serious pictures? And then they analyzed the pictures of the friends of the people and used this same analysis methodology, and the result was exactly the same. That is, people who have happy, smiling faces have more friends, and they have more friends who are also happy, and those people have happier friends, and those people have happier friends. So the point here is that happiness is not just an individual personal matter. One's happiness impacts other people, and it spreads really surprisingly far beyond your immediate social horizon. What it says to me is that we as individual members in our organizations have an enormous potential to help weave a positive, happy fabric within those organizations. And we need to take responsibility for doing that. It also suggests that we need to pay attention to who we hang out with if we want to feel good under these circumstances. Okay, the second general thing that I wanted to talk to you about is what we've learned about that people learn best with feedback about what they did right, not with feedback about their mistakes. That's absolutely contradictory to most of the intuition that many of us have, and so I want to emphasize it here. I emphasize it because under these conditions of change in our IT organizations, we're all going to have to learn how to do different things and to do things in different ways. And so creating an environment where people can learn those new ways is really important, and learning through positive feedback is important. The best example I know of this is a study of, in sports, people trying to learn to play golf. And they had a population of people that took golf lessons all together, and then they were sent off to practice doing their stuff. And they videotaped their practice. And then they brought their videotape back, and they sat down with a coach who looked at their videotape and gave them feedback about how what they should be doing. The thing is that half the coaches operated under an instruction that says, what you want to do is make a list of every mistake they make and go through and show them specifically how they can correct that mistake. Makes sense? The other set of coaches were told, don't do that. Ignore the mistakes. They didn't happen. Everything that that person does right, you put on your list, and you show them what they did right and that it was the right way to do this. Okay, which way do you think people learned better? I bet you think they learned from the positive examples because of the way I started this, and that's the exact truth. They did make much more rapid progress when they were told what they did right than being told what they did wrong. And there are many other studies about how parents focus on grades with kids. We usually focus on the low grades. We should be focusing on the high grades. The kind of feedback that grade school kids get about math, there's a lot of work there. The third general lesson is that in times of change, no one's going to engage in a change process with enthusiasm if it's in the context of threats or threatened or real criticism. There's a study of cardiac patients, people who had experienced heart attacks. And these people needed to make, you know, hard and significant changes in their lifestyle, diet, exercise, reduction of stress, and so on. Everyone was given the same set of instructions about what they needed to accomplish, but they were divided into two groups in terms of the way those instructions were delivered. One group was told, if you don't lose this weight, change what you eat, blah, blah, blah. Here's the probability that you're going to have another heart attack. Here's the expected reduction in your lifespan, so on. The other group was given a positive picture of the outcome. Here's how much better you're going to feel. You're going to look younger when you lose these 10 pounds. You're going to have more energy. Maybe your sex life is going to be better. And you can tell from the context I'm telling the story that the group that was given positive reasons to make these hard changes did, in fact, succeed in making more changes, and they persisted for a longer period of time. So help people that you're working with and help yourself. Remember the positive reasons for change and forget about all of that gloom and doom about what might happen if we fail. Oh, it's just trying to keep me on my toes here. Sometimes it works with the first click, sometimes it's five. How full is your bucket? Don Clifton, who I mentioned earlier, and Tom Rath wrote a book by this name in 2004. It's a simple little two-hour read book, so it won't cost you very much to look through it. But the important thing I want to heighten your interest in is it develops the metaphor of a bucket. And the claim is that each of us has a bucket that we carry around with us, and that bucket is always being filled up by good experiences, positive things that happen to us, and it's being decreased by negative experiences. When our bucket is full, we feel great. We're full of energy and creativity. And when it's empty, we feel depressed and tired. We also have a dipper, each of us, they say, in this metaphor. And we can use that dipper to put good stuff in other people's buckets. And when we put good stuff in other people's buckets, it also automatically puts a good thing in our bucket. That dipper lets us take things out of other people's buckets, too, through negative comments, pessimistic scenarios. And when we take things out of other people's buckets, they come out of our buckets as well. Now, when I read this, I thought, oh, this is, you know, one of those kind of touchy-feely things. And I did an experiment that they recommended, and so I'm going to convey that to you and suggest when you get home next week that you give it a try. For 1 week, turn yourself into Mr. or Ms. Sourpuss. When you walk in the morning, go in with a, you know, negative physical affect. Complain about having to park in the forest parking lot. Where are those people that are, you know, blocking your space in the front parking places? Complain about the difficulty you had in getting the requirements for that thing you had to write. The customer didn't give them to you. You're never going to be able to get there. You might even make fun of people, and you might point out their mistakes. Try that for a week, and on Friday afternoon, take an essay. How do you feel on Friday afternoon? And what about those people in the cubicles right around you? How do you think, are there even any people left in those cubicles around you? Then, having written that down for your own use, the next week, turn all that stuff off and go back to being a positive, constructive person who reports the good things that happen in your life. Oh, I saw the neatest thing on NPR this morning. Kind of things that add to other people's buckets and fill yours up. And then on Friday afternoon, look at how you feel and look at how other people feel and how many people are around you at that point in time. It really did work for me. I want to also say in this metaphor that buckets are leaky, and your bucket will spring a leak and slowly drip out if you allow yourself to dwell on negative consequences. It just drains the good stuff away if you keep that in your head. One of the techniques that I use when I find myself getting into those bucket leaking situations is I just go into debate mode and I challenge what I'm trying to tell myself is likely to be the case. And, you know, pretty soon I'm out there having convinced Polly the pessimist to take a more optimistic approach. So it's important to plug the bucket leaks. And under these circumstances, it really is important to keep everybody's bucket full. There's a Gallup study of over 4 million employees worldwide, and they found that individuals who receive regular recognition and praise and positive input in the workplace exhibit significantly higher productivity, they have greater engagement with their colleagues, they're more likely to stay with the organization, they receive higher customer satisfaction scores and greater loyalty from their customers, and interestingly, they have better safety records. So what I'm telling you is not something that Clifton and Rath made up because it sounded nice. It really is the case. Also, keep in mind that dipping good stuff into other people's buckets can be just as simple as a smile and gentle treatment in a world that's not being very gentle to people these days. One more piece of research. I want to talk about positive-negative ratios. For a long time, I worked at Indiana University in Bloomington, and John Gottman was a member of the faculty there. He has done a very interesting study, a long-term study, of interactions among married people and marital success. And the study that I want to very briefly highlight here is he interviewed a series of, I think, 700 or 800 newlywed couples. And part of the interview process was simply to leave them alone in a room, and they were talking to each other, and he videotaped their interactions. After the fact, and this was a 15-minute tape, mind you, so a very short snapshot of what was going on between these two people. After that, he had people who didn't know anything about the research he was doing code every interaction. That was positive, that was negative, that was positive, 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 negative, positive, blah, 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 blah. Stuck the stuff away for a while. 10 years later, he contacted all of those couples and found out were they still married or not. And the result was amazing. If there was a ratio of 5 to 1, positive to negative, just chit-chat, interactions among the couple in that 15-minute slice of time, they were more likely to still be married after 10 years with a 94% prediction success, which is just amazing level of ability to predict an outcome like that. Another group of researchers more recently, Fredrickson and Lasada, went into the workplace and also taped interactions among people in a small work group. And what they found was that there was there also a magic ratio. In this case, it had to be at least 3 positive reactions to every 1 negative reaction. And if that level of positivity existed, the group was much more productive. The thing about the second study that's very interesting, though, is that some work groups were so positive, the ratios were like 13 to 1 and higher, and when you get up into that realm of positivity, it was absolutely counterproductive. And one thing I should have said before this is in focusing on the positive, I'm not suggesting becoming a Pollyanna. I'm not suggesting glossing over reality. I'm not suggesting spinning. I'm talking about really emphasizing the positive vision and the direction that you're trying to go in a constructive way. So the point is, you can be so positive that everybody knows that you're not genuine, and That's not what we're talking about. Okay, the second discipline, appreciative inquiry. What you'll see here is that appreciative inquiry is based on the very basic fundamentals of positive psychology, but its focus is not on the individual. Its focus is on organizations and how you get organizations to change. Something we need to know about right now. A name that you might want to Google if you want to know more about this is David Cooper Ryder. David Cooper Ryder. Beginning back in the mid-80s, I guess, he founded an approach to organizational change that was based on enlisting people's imagination about the most positive future for their organization that they could aspire to, and how to make that positive future a reality. Now, that's in the context of organizational development, which at that point in time, and I have to say, sadly, too much today as well, is practiced when the consultant comes in and they do their interviews, they do their surveys, they do their workshops, and they want you to write down everything that's wrong with the organization, and they want you to prioritize it from the worst to the least worst, and then we're going to figure out how to go off and problem solve on those worst, really bad problems. Well, Cooper Ryder's argument is that people, as we've been trying to establish, people don't sign on for a change agenda when it's based on negative reasons. They sign on when they're inspired by the outcome that they want to achieve. Sometimes that's a lot about how you phrase the question about what change you want to achieve. Let me give you an example. There's a report about a Fortune 500 company that had a very serious sexual harassment problem. And they had engaged one of the big consulting firms to come in and eliminate the sexual harassment in this company. Well, the consultants did what many of them do. They came in and they interviewed, they surveyed, they had workshops, they told the employees what the risk to the company, the legal aspects of sexual harassment, and all the things that you absolutely must not do or you're going to be guilty of sexual harassment. After a year or two of this, the consulting firm came to the conclusion that nothing was happening. Now, the people were doing the same things that they had been doing in spite of this expensive intervention. To their credit, the consultants contacted Cooper Ryder's group, and they helped them figure out a different way of asking the question. Instead of, how can we blot out this bad thing, they asked the question, how can we become a new organization which is a model of high-quality cross-gender relationships in the workplace? So it's underlying the same issue, but it's focusing on what you want to do rather than what you don't want to do. And that's the point here. After a couple of years, this particular organization was actually cited for an exemplary gender-friendly culture because the employees were energized and actively addressed this issue. So pay attention to how you phrase the question and then focus on what you want more of in this change process rather than what you want less of. That's just the opposite of what many of us do, especially those of us in IT and higher ed. We've been drilled in critical thinking, problem solving, and we're very good at those activities. But they can be very destructive if they're applied to the wrong degree and in the wrong context. Learn to see what you want more of. Sometimes it's hard for us to keep in mind the positive steps in the direction that we're trying to accomplish change. We need to repeat that positive vision of a better future over and over for ourselves and other people as well. And I don't have time, but there are studies that show that the rehearsal, the mental rehearsal that you do, actually has a palpable effect on the performance that you bring forward. We need to see the positive future, and we need to track the steps toward that positive future and celebrate those. And then we all need to learn how to fan those positive examples of what we want more of to make it happen. There's a story of an Indian spiritual leader and a boy. The old man tells the boy that there are two wolves that live within him. There's one good wolf and one bad wolf. And these two wolves are constantly fighting to make the boy choose either right or wrong. Boy kind of scratches his head and he asks the old man, "Well, what determines which wolf wins?" And the old man says, "Whichever one you feed." And that's really true. Negativity breeds negativity, and positivity breeds positively. As members of a team in your organization, you can help by being extra present and visible. Drop in your colleagues' cubicles. Show that you feel confident about your project and positive about the future. Pay attention to your teammates and what they're doing, checking in. And, you know, if you can offer to help when they're snowed under, it makes a huge difference. Stay cool. Nobody needs you to be panicked. Tell the truth and a lot of it. Under conditions of stress, it's very helpful to put out a weekly progress report, letting everybody know right where things are. Sometimes there's bad news in there. Emphasize the good news, but don't hide the bad news. But let everybody know where things stand. Being in a vacuum when it's a scary world is a bad thing. Keep everybody focused on the mission critical. This is not a time to go off and spend time indulging in secondary issues. Describe the realistic, positive future repeatedly, and expose every ounce of progress that you see toward that future. And I want to put in a plug here. I know a lot of you are directors and CIOs, but some of you may not be. And I want to say that what I've just said here about your teammates also applies going up the food chain. The guys in the CIO and director's office sometimes are in a very lonely environment. They see all the bad things that have to be done, and it really can help them a lot if you can send some positive feedback in their direction. But, you say, there's that guy in the next cubicle who is so negative. I can't have a positive attitude because of that guy. Well, here's some concrete suggestions. One of the things you can do is you can acknowledge that they are being negative. And you can give all the reasons why the way you think the world is going to be are more likely and better than the way they think the world is likely to be. So engage in an argument with them about their naysaying. If that doesn't help turn down the temperature on their complaints, you can make clear in a very direct way that their negative attitude is part of the problem. And essentially ask them to try to contribute, because the way they're being is part of what's making it hard to get through all of this. You do need to create that positive vision for the other people who hear that, and you need to repeat that every time you have an opportunity, because you can be sure the naysayers are repeating their negative view of the outcomes every time they have an opportunity. Again, expose every scintilla of progress. And in the end, if you can't get them to be more positive, you may have to get rid of them. If you're a director or a manager or a supervisor, that may mean moving them out of a work group situation, putting them in an individual contributor role off in a corner someplace where it minimizes the damage. You may need to fire them if you can't do that. And if you're not a manager and you can't take those steps, at least take the step of getting yourself out from the influence of their attitude, and other people will follow your example. So, when you go back to work next week, take a look at your colleagues and ask yourself, how full are their buckets? Try the little experiment that I suggested earlier, and then make it part of your own personal new job description that you're going to try to ruthlessly eliminate those behaviors that you have that dip from other people's buckets, emptying them out in your own in the process, and that you become a regular bucket filler. You might go back and say, I'm going to make a resolution that in the next month I'm going to send 5 short thank you emails to some colleague who's done something that I see has been helpful around here. And you might continue doing that after the month. How full is your bucket? It's your job to keep track of how full your bucket is. If it starts getting low, it's your job to take steps to fill it back up. And keep in mind that everything we've said to now, if you fill other people's buckets, it will fill yours as well. But outside the workplace, maybe you can volunteer at the local hospital or tutor non-English speakers, or help young kids learn to read, or deliver hot lunches to shut-ins, or do some work at the local food pantry. There are many ways outside of work to fill up your own bucket by dipping into buckets of others. Many of you know that I'm an enthusiastic dog person. And, of course, I make it a point to get my daily fix of dog kisses and tail wags and pets. I just want to emphasize that research does show that pets can significantly lower your stress and help fill our emotional buckets. And there are even studies that suggest that people get more bucket filling from their pets than from their spouses. Or maybe exercise is a bucket filler for you. Whatever it is, take responsibility for your own optimistic outlook and then pass that outlook on to others. Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. I hope you'll make this simple message one of your New Year's resolutions and make a difference in how you feel and watch it spread to other people. Thank you.
A speech by Polly McClure, Vice President Emeritus for Cornell University. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.